listen, we're very fortunate. We have now joining us Isaac Saney and of Dalhousie University, and author of a very important book, A Revolution in Motion, Cuba. And Isaac, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, we saw you on CBC. I tell people, go there. You gave a very wonderful account of the Cuban Revolution and dealt with the kind of questions that the CBC is obligated to ask you. And you really gave them the word they need, context.
Well, I have to say it's been a tough trial. I've been up since 2 a.m. with very little sleep since Saturday morning, because as everybody else, I'm dealing with profound pain, sorrow, shock that Fidel is no longer physically with us. And I've been doing a number of interviews, right? I've done quite a few, and except for one, all of them have been faced with this question where basically this kind of right-wing propaganda against Cuba, this kind of decontextualization. So it can be quite challenging to do so. And I just hope that I'm doing a good enough job to dispel some of that propaganda.
Yeah.
That distortion, that disinformation.
Well, when they deal with you, they have a handful. I was very impressed.
Well, that's a good thing. When I speak so fast that sometimes they can't cut me off.
We have all noticed that, and it's a great quality. Now, we just spoke to Ramsey Clark, and he was an eyewitness. He went with Sean McBride, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, to Angola. He said he arrived there 2 days after the destruction of the apartheid army that had entered Angola, thinking they were going to destroy that government. And I know this is something close to your heart, and it's so important people don't know about.
Well, it's incredibly close to my heart because some people remember when Nelson Mandela died in December of 2013 and they had the international ceremony to commemorate him and had all these dignitaries there. President Raul Castro of Cuba was accorded an extremely prominent position, and many people didn't understand it. They thought it was kind of unusual. And so there's been this attempt to erase this history that Cuba played in Southern Africa, right? I mean, Fidel Castro has iconic heroic status throughout Africa, especially in Southern Africa, because of this decisive role that Cuba played. And what people need to realize is that that when the apartheid state suddenly began to be surrounded by independent black states in the 70s, particularly Angola, Mozambique, they launched a war of terror, a war that people call a war of destabilization. I call a war of terror that cost hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives, causing tens of billions of dollars of economic damages. And this was this lasted from 1975 up until 1988. And the key battleground was Angola. And they invaded in 1975. The Angolans issued international SOS calling for assistance. Cuba was the only country to respond with the amount of resources and assistance that was able to repel the South Africans. And this was the first time the invincible white army had been defeated. And the Cubans stayed there as a bulwark against continued South African aggression. And one of the most notorious examples, obviously, is the May 1978 massacre. Mm-hmm. I think it was May 4th, 1978 massacre of Namibian refugees in Kasinga, which was a small town in Angola, killing hundreds of people, and then they also kidnapped a number of them because the South Africans launched this attack from Namibia, which bordered Angola, and Namibia was sort of occupied illegally by South Africa, and it was a Namibian national liberation struggle for independence. So the Cuban state is a bulwark against this terrorist attack, and then in 1988, there was a series of engagements around a town called Quito Cuanavale where the South Africans basically intervened. There was an Angolan offensive that was lost in 87 against UNITA, which was a puppet South African CIA-sponsored organization. And the South Africans intervened quite decisively to save UNITA, and in that caused so much Angolan death, and they were so successful that they thought they could now move from a limited operation, which was to save this group called UNITA, to actually delivering a fatal blow to Angola, and therefore ending Angola's existence as an independent state. They would install their own puppet leader. And a critical moment developed, and Angolans asked Cuba to step in. And so Cuba stepped in, sent thousands of additional troops, eventually building up to over 53,000 troops that were in Angola. 40,000 of them ended up being in the south of Angola. To get into too long a story, they actually committed a tremendous strategic coup, and they transformed the military balance of power in Angola, leading to the South Africans being defeated, having to retreat into Namibia. And this set in to trail a series of events, eventually leading to the South African military being toppled from the apex of state power in South Africa. And this opened up the way for Mandela's freedom and for a whole number of different things. And Mandela himself acknowledged this. So Cuba's contribution was tremendous. And, you know, over 330,000, close to 400,000 Cuban soldiers rotated through Angola in those years, with over 2,000 shedding their blood and actually dying, right? Mm-hmm. So it's often said that Cuba is the only country to have actually gone to Africa and returned with nothing but the coffins of its sons and daughters who died in the struggle to liberate Africa. A profound story. And so when people think of Mandela's friendship with Fidel and Mandela's deep affection for Fidel, they always think of it as an unusual thing. No, it is grounded in actual, concrete, historical, internationalist acts of solidarity of the Cuban Revolution. Without those acts, there would not have been this deep friendship between Mandela and Fidel.
Yeah, it was not a mere gesture or just a one-off. I just was reading an interview, a guy compiled a biography of Fidel through interviews, and he said that Fidel, it's Gabriel Marquez said this. Marquez said that Fidel knew every single detail of what was happening in Angola. He knew where he was moving the pins on the map. He knew who was fighting who, and he was giving tactical advice.
Yeah, well, what happened was, you know, there's a number of cables that go back and forth between Havana and Cuito Cuanaval at particular points, right? I mean, I don't want to go into the details, but each time Fidel is saying, you need to do this, you need to do that, or you're courting a disaster, right? And a disaster happened, right? Okay, and and you know, and he's sending these here, and then finally, you know, when the battle is, you know, being waged, you know, Fidel is basically spending 24 hours, almost all of his time, in the battle, on the battlefield, right? Not on the battle, he's in Cuba, but he's there constantly focused, right, on giving orders, on getting updates on what's unfolding. Because he made a very important point. He said, you know, when Cuba decided, like, what happened is when the Angolan situation, it reached a critical point. The Cubans made a decision. They said, one, they had to save Angola from defeat, but also they decided this was the time to put the resources that Cuba had and that were available. They put enough resources in Angola, military resources, that they could deliver a final blow to South Africa to finally stop the South African threat. So they actually stripped Havana of its anti-aircraft defenses. They sent their most seasoned and veteran troops from Cuba. They sent planes. They sent tanks. Right? They, in a sense, denuded the island of much of its best military equipment and soldiers to save Angola. And don't forget, they're doing this at the time of when Reagan, this hyper-aggressive Reagan, is in power. So you know, they took a big chance, right? And if they had been defeated in Angola, if this had failed, if their strategy had failed, you know, it would have been a tremendous moral blow to Cuba, and possibly, as Fidel said, could have meant the end of the Cuban Revolution. So they gambled. They gambled the existence of the Cuban Revolution on the basis of aiding another sister and brother people in Africa. And Cuba has always had this particular relationship with Africa, always had this particular feeling that there is a historic debt owed by humanity to Africa because of the transatlantic slave trade and the ravages of colonialism. And Cuba has made it, and the Cuban revolutionary leadership, with Fidel at its head, has always attempted through a variety of means, first to aid the African national liberation and anti-colonial struggles, and then by sending out thousands of doctors. These have been means by which Cuba has attempted to assist Africa in basically throwing off the legacy of colonialism, but also repaying that historical debt to Africa and to Africans.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Isaac Saini. He's the author of Cuba, A Revolution in Motion. And incidentally, Isaac, that's clearly a demonstration, isn't it, that internationalism is not a word or it's not a sentiment. It actually is what guarantees success.
No, that's true. It's not, you know, Cuba has engaged in international activity without reciprocity, i.e. the idea that I do not engage in international relations or do not give you something unless I receive something back. Cuba has really established a new model of international relations, this idea of internationalism, this idea that basically oppressed and exploited should be aided. And so in the case of Africa, you know, one of the most exploited, if not the most exploited continents, ravaged by transatlantic slave trade, ravaged by colonialism, Cuba has felt this basic fundamental duty. And Fidel has said that clearly, this is a fundamental human duty to come to the aid of people who are suffering under colonialism, suffering under exploitation and oppression. And at the end of the day, what you have created are new people, people who come out with a certain selfless solidarity, with a certain sense of altruism, people who are, in a sense, driven by the ethos of being, i.e., you know, my selfhood as a human being is determined by what contribution I can make to other human beings, the well-being of other human beings, as opposed to the ethos of having, which is my selfhood is determined by how many material goods I accumulate. It's a difficult thing in a capitalist society to appreciate, right? Where everything is so materialistic. Even if you have the philosophy of socialism, it's very hard. And so we live in a quid pro quo world, as you point out. Cuba has sort of created a new model.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, good example, as you know, we said, is like, you know, the conditions have changed, but Cuba still maintains its solidarity. So, for example, instead of soldiers, Cuba sent doctors and educators to Africa and across the world. So at any given day, there's probably 30,000 to 40,000 Cuban medical personnel serving in over 50 to 60 different countries across the world, many of them serving almost at cost, in fact, at very low wages. So, for example, very low cost. So, for example, some countries do pay Cuba for the medical personnel because they can afford to. So most African countries, because they're poor, don't. And these doctors go there and they work in the poorest areas. And they come back, having witnessed the poverty in these countries, they come back with their sense of the ethos of solidarity and being enhanced. So these are quite powerful things. So when the Ebola epidemic swept through West Africa, Cuba was the first on the ground. When the earthquake hit Haiti, Cuba doctors were the first on the ground. And we see this time and time and time and time again.
Yes.
Even when Cuba was ravaged by Hurricane Matthew and Barakoa, and certain sections of eastern Cuba were destroyed and devastated, right? And Cuba's dealing with the immense cost of rebuilding those areas. Even when that was happening, Cuba sent medical reinforcements to their brigade in Haiti, even when Cuba was dealing with all of these issues it was facing. So it's a remarkable country. It's a remarkable example of altruistic and international foreign policy. And Fidel Castro himself was the central figure behind this.
Yeah, great phenomenon. I have to ask you, I know we have to let you go, but one last thing. He has, my impression, look, he faced embargo, blockade, sanctions, invasion. But he built an organization. People have to, some people say, oh, well, now it's post-Fidel. He built something there. Tell us quickly your confidence in that group.
Yeah, but I think it's important to understand institutions exist in Cuba. Institutions are what basically govern Cuba. Individuals obviously play the role within those institutions. So there's been a certain conception of, a certain Fidel-centric conception of Cuba. And of course, because his personality, his own, shall we say, value as a human being, right? His dimensions are so immense that many people did not see that there was this institutional framework in which Fidel fit. I mean, it's important to understand that during the course of the Cuban Revolution, when Fidel was in his positions of authority within the Cuban state, there were several debates he lost, right? Okay, several key debates on the economy and certain other things as well. But, you know, and so he was more of a unifying force. The debates took place, and once a decision was made, whether Fidel won or lost on those critical debates in the leadership, then, you know, Fidel represented that unified position, right? So it's important to understand that. So what happened is that, you know, people, I always like to say, people predicted Cuba could not survive without being an economic appendage of the United States, right? And when the revolution triumphed and the U.S. broke relations with Cuba diplomatically and then economically, nobody predicted Cuba survived, and they survived. Then everybody predicted Cuba could never survive the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? And Cuba survived that.
Survived.
And then people said, well, the revolution could never survive without Fidel being front and center in power. And when Fidel became sick in 2006 and stepped down, there was a peaceful transfer of authority from Fidel to Raul Castro. And what we've seen was that under Fidel, it had begun and it's been intensified under Raul Castro. There's a transition, right, from the historic generation that made the revolution, that has that burden of all the responsibilities of having made a revolution. There's a transition from them to the new generation, the younger generation of Cuban leadership. And that's happening, right? And, you know, Raul Castro himself, who's step down in early 2018, probably February of 2018, and we'll have the new generation coming to the helm of the Cuban state. All this is taking place in the institutions that were created. It's important to understand that Fidel always was a loyal soldier of the Communist Party of Cuba. Whatever people may think about communism, think of communist parties, Fidel was a loyal soldier of that party. So while his his personality and his figure loomed large, it's important that he existed and operated within this constitutional framework and this institutional framework. And it's these institutions that Fidel himself put in place, played a major role in putting this, that will continue to govern Cuba, and we'll see a new generation rise to the forefront. I mean, the passing of Fidel is an incredible moment of grief and sorrow and mourning for the Cuban people. Okay, that's undoubted, right? It's very difficult for me and others to think of Cuba and the world without the physical presence of Fidel. But it's not this kind of political, economic, transformative moment. Cuban revolution will continue. Its defense of its independence and its project of social justice will continue. They're in the process of renovating, refurbishing, renewing, whichever term people wish to use, the economy so they can create the most prosperous and sustainable basis for socialism in the future. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to understand this, and I think your point was quite correct. Fidel is incredible and giant, is gone, but the institutional framework that he played a very important role in putting in place continue.
Well, Isaac Saini, you couldn't have summed it up better. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me, Phil, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you. We look forward to seeing you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Isaac Saini, and the book is A Revolution, Cuba, A Revolution in Motion. And Isaac Saini is a man in motion. He's on his way to a meeting. We shared the time with us. And you can. CBC keeps its interviews, and there was one he gave it 10 minutes, and a brilliant job. And this is the Tato Report. And it's CIUT 89.5 FM, and we have a little something I think from in support of the no to the Dakota Access Pipeline, and we're going to play a clip of it, and I think we'll have time to say a little bit more.
If the cops there want to be state-sanctioned agents to brutally beat nonviolent veterans that have served their country honorably, if they're going to beat us, then that should be the signal to the rest of the world with our country. Guys that are 80, guys that are 21 and just got out, we have cops, we have medics. We have male, female, disabled. Right now, we have enough civilians and everybody else that wasn't in the military or police, and they're coming in trying to say, hey, help, like, how can we help? What can we do? Native American people in this country have served at a higher percentage in the United States military than any group in this entire country. The Navajos saved us through code talking and being able to pass intelligence around. If there was one group in this country that's adequately and thoroughly represents the military, it is the Native American people. If you are a conservative, this is limited government. If you're a libertarian and you want freedom for your people, this is it right here. If you're against money in politics and you don't want to see our police and soldiers being treated like private employees to beat our citizens, also, it doesn't matter where you come from in your approach, this is your fight.
That was the voice of Michael Wood. He is from Baltimore. He's a former policeman and soldier, and he's calling on veterans to, and he says he's getting a lot of support to go and stand in solidarity with Standing Rock. If you want more information, as you know, one of our leaders is Susan Sarandon. Go to her Twitter and get your instructions. If she asks you to do something, do it. She's a terrific person, not only a great actress, and so we do need people. Remember, the first thing you need to do is be Fidel-like and inform yourself. The one thing you get from speaking to Ramsey Clark, Isaac Saini, or our encounters with Fidel and observing, he was an intellectual in the good sense of the word. He thought it's important to understand the facts, get your information, and be able to represent the cause. And not just, you know, be a noise or somebody who periodically does something. He lived it. And going to support the No Dakota Access Pipeline, you have to know what this is about. This is, Hani and I were talking before the show, they want to put a pipeline, oil pipeline, under the Missouri River. That's like an insult to God. Do you see that? These beautiful rivers, a source of energy and agriculture and commerce, and you're going to put an oil line under it. Who? You and which bank? See, we don't have a people's democracy where you could say, no, we have. Where's all the people discussing it? The only people discussing are Wall Street people and some master builder somewhere who says, it'd be fun to have a pipeline. Profit is what determines the whole thing. So it's a very important fight. And, of course, we should never talk about the Dakota access and this whole issue without invoking the names of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull, who defended the Black Hills, which had been given to them. Not given, there was a treaty recognized that the Black Hills belonged to their people. They died in defense of that cause, and here we are, 2016. And of course, there is America's holding a prisoner, Leonard Peltier. And it's in the power of the President of the United States to free Leonard Peltier. And he should recognize that Leonard Peltier is a man from another nation. He's not just an American. He's an American. This is his people were displaced. They are real. They have this international law. There's United Nations, all recognized. And as the leader of the United States, recognizing another people who have been violated by the United States, it's a simple act, and it would be something the world would respect. President Obama should do the right thing and free Leonard Peltier. And people say, crimes were committed. Do you know anything about the struggle between natives and white people? Yeah, there's a lot of crimes. So when you have respected leaders, release them and make peace. You've been listening to The Tater Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and we'll see you next week.